This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 530 of what may be the world's greatest writing podcast. On today's show, I talked to my friend Jamie Hecker about his debut book devoted to Walt Disney history in relationship to Washington, D.C. So as I've recently observed, this show is a kind of a continuing MFA program for me, allowing me to continue having the conversations I had while at NYU as a very spoiled writer in a dreamy writing program. Side note, after I finished my MFA, it took about a year and a half for me to finally miss those conversations. As an extension of the MFA experience, or perhaps as a recreation of the non-writing parts of an MFA, this show mostly focuses on literature via poetry, novels, and memoir. But those of you who've stuck around, and thank you for those of you who have, also know that I'm inclined to meander into pop culture, history, music, comedy, philosophy, and sooner or later, the Disney phenomenon. I am an addict. Now, I don't love the Disney phenomenon indiscriminately, and in fact, when my non-Disney-loving friends learn about how I appreciate this pop culture phenomenon, they think that the strange fact of my caring about the mouse seems exponentially stranger, though they also do tend to understand it better. The fundamental key to my obsession, I think, is that I want to live in a cartoon. But not just any cartoon. A great cartoon. Another key thing is that over the years, I've acquired some knowledge about Disney history and think that this is really interesting and think that it continues to be interesting. Through Disney historians such as Todd James Pierce, Didier Guez, and Jamie Hecker, I keep learning new things. And during the dark times of the Disney company, when the people governing what this behemoth is going to do don't care about its own history or legacy, the history becomes so much more important as there is little to look forward to. I miss drinking, dear listeners. When I think back to my childish and adolescent obsessions, most of them don't get more interesting the more I learn about them. Sorry, Quiet Riot. To people who are rather unsnared by the Disney thing, or ensnared only insofar as their children let maybe the awfulness of the Disney Channel and musical earworms wash over their families, the fact of Disney fans having a library of Disney-specific books might seem strange. My Disney-inspired YouTube channel is called The Strangest Mouse, but there's a lot of fascinating information in that repository, and it is not about nostalgia. Well, not mostly. Let's talk to Jamie.
And now, the interview of the day.
Dear listeners, my guest today is Jamie Hecker, who is a Disney historian. I met him, or became aware of him, when the both of us worked for a wonderful Disney fanzine. I would say it's like semi-pro, called Celebrations. And we became friends. I think we've met each other in person, I think, twice. So our friendship is one of those glories of the internet where like-minded people were able to find each other. And I'm proud to announce that his first book, Walt Goes to Washington, Finding Disney in DC, is now out. So congratulations, Jamie.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John. You're absolutely right. We did meet at an event at Disney World for a Celebrations magazine, and then we connected on another visit. If memory serves, I think we went to the 50s sci-fi dine-in theater.
Yeah, which is maybe my favorite place to eat, even though the food's all right. Like, it's not amazing food. It's not bad, which actually is something to note at Walt Disney World. To anyone who hasn't been there, you go inside and it looks like you're behind the scenes on a movie set, and then you cross that border into the movie set and it looks like you're outdoors at a drive-in movie theater, and you sit in cars a la Pulp Fiction, and they have an hour-long loop of B-roll, bizarro sci-fi stuff, mostly from the 50s and 60s.
Yes.
There's a Tom and Jerry cartoon, which I thought was very generous that Disney would show that. I think that was probably
that part of the MGM contract at
probably. Probably. Yeah. And the first time we met, it was backstage at Disney's Hollywood Studios at this secret location that I never knew was there. So I felt
that makes
like
two of us. Yep.
I felt like
private event room.
Whenever I'm backstage at Disney parks, even though they're usually boring, I don't know, I get filled with like electricity, like, oh, this is the insider stuff that if they knew better, they would not let me see.
Exactly. Yes. That's why it's on stage and off. A very quick sidebar. In high school, our marching band went down to Florida, Miami for the Orange Bowl parade. And then we came back to the Magic Kingdom in Epcot in its first year. And we marched in the Magic Kingdom and we got to set up backstage behind Adventureland. So yeah, that's a unique take, seeing the cables and the tubing and Donald without his head on. That's quite the experience.
Well, I recall there was a mother who got arrested at a Disney park, and because they were taken to the Magic Kingdom's security location in the Utilidors, her child saw one of the characters without the head, and she claimed that was traumatic. And I remember thinking, that's BS, that like you got caught in a crime and now you want to cry like you're a victim.
Yeah.
But it's like, I've seen one of the characters without the head on, and I have to say it is pretty messed up to see.
It's
like, it's more disturbing than you would think, or than I thought anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of the lawsuits about people who say they got the bends when they were going down to a Seabase Alpha on the non-functioning elevator.
Yeah. The floor of the elevator wobbles and you're like, ooh, all right. This is, and
really happening.
I think you were descending 0 inches.
Correct.
I think you walk out the back. So that's the
illusion.
That's the magic trick. Yeah.
Precisely.
So you live in the DC area, don't you?
Yes, I do. I've been kind of a lifer here now. I spent more time here than any place else. I grew up in Indiana. I went to Purdue. You have connections to Purdue, if I recall.
PhD came from Purdue.
Okay. I wasn't sure which degree, but yes, thank you. So I have a lowly BA in American history. And after college, I didn't have a clear chart or roadmap. So I moved out to DC with my then girlfriend, and that didn't last, but I stayed here. And I worked at a ski shop for a while, just for the winter season. Then I got a job on Capitol Hill for basically poverty wages, and it eventually grew. But I spent 6 fascinating years working as a congressional aide. Yeah, this is grunt work. This is before the internet. So you're answering the phone, answering mail.
Talk about backstage.
Yeah, exactly. I did congressional tours a lot. Gee, that's in the news these days. Or Capitol Dome tours to constituents, because the congressman is he's too busy for that. So the highlights.
One would hope.
It did have its perks, though. I did get to attend not one, but two State of the Union speeches up in the gallery. Every member of Congress gets a ticket. The congressman I work for, his wife had done it X number of times and wasn't interested. So they raffled it off to staff members. And I came up deuces on two times. So I got to see the second of Bush Sr., one of his last ones, and one of the first of Clinton's. And when our boss retired in 96, the staff pressed him for a Capitol Dome tour, which has to be escorted by a congressman. And that's something else. You get to the very top. That's the best view in Washington. Beats out the Washington Monument. So, yeah. So D.C. is my home. Since then, I switched careers. I went into IT, doing government consulting on various tech platforms. I've made a good run at this. Stayed in the area. I get to dabble with my fascination with U.S. history. And because there's so much just a stone's throw away, is an embarrassment of riches for me. So you brought it up earlier, how I write for Celebrations. I've been doing that for a decade now. And I just started with special interest columns. And then as I've gotten to know the publisher, we kind of focused in on some specific areas. So I'm writing...
Tim
Foster. So I write pretty much exclusively now on Disney legends. And so as of today, there are 290 or so men and women who are in that category. So I try to do a deep dive. My goal is to learn something new every time I write. So I've had this idea of noodling, festering, germinating in my head about all the DC connections, Disney connections to DC. And I says, well, is this a column for the magazine? It's kind of a short article limit, 2,000-ish word count. I can make this a blog post, a series of blogs. And I kept never getting around to making a decision. Sidebar, when COVID came around, I had been dealing with a lower form of a blood cancer. And when COVID came out, with an immune system that was compromised, it made sense for me to step away from work. So I went away out on short-term disability and onto long-term. Now, to make a short story long, it upgraded itself to leukemia. I went ahead with a stem cell transplant, and that has worked for me. That's the bad news. The good news is I had so much time on my hands sitting at home. And with some nudging for some friends, I said, hey, didn't you have an idea for a book? Because at that time in my head, it was like, okay, this is going to be a book form. And I said, well,
That's the problem with those projects that we don't bother to actually start is we keep accumulating more material and more tangents and relevant subjects so that eventually you're like, well, now it's going to be hard to start because now it's going to be too big.
Right. You have to define the scope. And I felt I had a pretty narrow scope, but I still found myself going down rabbit holes looking for new material. So it really became a question of who would publish this. I don't want to write a manuscript per se. I don't want to sound arrogant or anything like that, but I don't want to invest time if it's not going to be received. So I looked around my bookcase and some of my favorite authors, my Disney historians, used Theme Park Press. Jim Corcus, Didier Gaze, for example. I went to the website and there's a page to solicit ideas. Like, well, the worst thing they'll do is say no. So I pitched him the concept of highlighting all the areas of interconnection, like the Venn diagram between Disney, the man, the company, the brand, and Washington, D.C., be it the government or social institutions, i.e. the Smithsonian. And there was also a proposed Disney park which I lived through all that. That was in my time frame. So I got a reply back, says, this is fascinating. Some of these topics have been well covered before, but your angle, your focus, it's the right approach. So I got the green light to submit a manuscript. And then I thought, oh, I have to do this now. So, I had the luxury of time, to borrow that time-worn cliche, when one door closes, another door opens. So I just started outlining my thoughts. I went down agency by agency, the presidents. There's Walt has a rich history with presidents, all of various degrees of interest. Not every president, but in his lifetime, in the company's lifetime, lots of presidents before, in office, and after office have been to the Disney parks, either for personal reasons or campaign reasons. It was fascinating because my first stopping point when I got the green light was I need to contact the Disney archives to see what I can get.
So they could say no.
Yeah, kind of. I very politely got a talk to our lawyers first, and I went back to my publisher who greenlit the project. I says, hey, is this worth pursuing? He goes, honestly, no. The archives, when Dave Smith ran it, was a little more receptive to outside researchers, but it's really locked down. It's strictly internal. And I respect that. They have a brand to protect. They have plenty of material, which is manuscripts, even papers and photos might be decades old. So I wasn't imagining myself getting on an airplane, but I just wanted to knock on the door to see what might happen. So it boiled down to doing research on the internet. And the beautiful thing, especially when I was researching presidents, the National Archives is responsible for all of the presidential websites. There was a story about Clinton, President Clinton, while in office, he visited the Disney Institute. I've kept coming across this one sentence out there in all my research, and nobody was sharing any details. So I had on his library website, his daily agenda, and I'm searching, brute force searching Disney, Orlando. I'm getting nothing. They just must not have indexed the page. So my alternate source was a subscription to newspapers.com. I'm going through the Orlando paper. Okay, Clinton's in office this time frame. Disney Institute is this time frame. Narrowed it down, and lo and behold, I finally found an article. And then I traced back to the Clinton library and found the agenda. He and Gore were doing a tour of Florida on some policy initiative. And Clinton's last stop of the day at 9:30 p.m. was at MCO, caravan out to Disney Institute, checked in for the night, left the next morning at 8:30. So not even 12 hours.
Well, the Disney Institute is probably the coolest place a president could have visited.
Yes.
So for my Drunken Odyssey listeners, that was a location, I think it went for about a decade, but it was like a continuing education program for adults so that if you wanted to spend a weekend or a week learning from master chefs, like how to be a better cook, you could do that. If you wanted to, you know, practice art, they had all the arts. If you wanted to learn how to be an animator, I don't know how, you know, you might end up working hard to make a 10-second film, but there was a lot of instruction so that if you found either Disney films or the Disney experience in the parks to be inspiring, you know, like one of the thoughts I have is, oh, I need to try and make my home a little bit more like the fun of this place or the beauty of this place. You could learn how to do some of that. And so like to see a president in fantasy land, I don't know, but you know, in a place of learning and someone who valued learning as much as Clinton, hopefully he still does, but it just seems like there's going to be fewer people, but it probably would have a bigger impact.
Yeah.
They had guest speakers and surprises all the time at the Disney Institute, but when it's the president, like that's going to be an unusual day.
Yes, yes. And like I said, I thought, was he there for a session? Was he speaking, ribbon cutting? Nope. It was just the last stop of a long travel day. And the next morning he went to a convention in Orlando. So yeah, the Disney Institute, as it was then, is no more. It was morphed into Saratoga Springs Resort. The Disney Institute exists online as like a business vehicle to like learn how to run your business the Disney way, something to that effect.
Well, I think this is one of the reasons why I care so much about Disney history is the things I love, and I didn't even go to the Disney Institute, but the things I love often go away, mm-hmm. and then I'm kind of heartbroken. So there's a part of me who, through my Strangest Mouse video series, like I'm just like, here's some scenery, just because I want to be able to imagine this is what it was like if I could hang out in fantasy land, you know, in the rain. So I've got the view of the castle from the Village House, the Pinocchio restaurant, and like the camera was out of the rain, but it was like rainfall and the castle, and the carousel and the castle are the least likely to disappear. But yeah. I'm paranoid. But one of the great things about your book is, of course, Walt Disney's patriotism wasn't always blind, but it was this powerful force.
Yes.
And I think that it could be difficult, I think, for people today who, one, we live in such a partisan age that to just say, oh, I love government, like, I don't think there's anyone who's likely to have that belief. Oh, I love my party. I love my take on the way government should run, but I don't necessarily love government. And so what your book does is provides a lot of context for just how this played out in Walt Disney's lifetime. And I think if you have a particular political point of view, you're probably not going to be happy, no matter what your persuasion is, with Walt Disney's way of approaching history. For example, you know, like he could say, I'm trying to remember how it was described in the Dedication for Disneyland, but something like the hard spots of history or the rough spots. Mm. And like, he's, you know, like there he is, Walt Disney, King Optimist. And while it certainly isn't necessarily shining a bright light on genocide and slavery, he's also acknowledging, you know, how the complexity of history. And Davy Crockett, like, okay, like it's not a simple story.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. It was Zorro, to borrow the same similar vein of television of American history. I knew this for a long time as a Disney historian. You know, Walt's father was an avowed socialist and an itinerant worker. He moved the family whenever he needed a new job. That's why Walt was born in Chicago, moved to Marceline, moved to Kansas City. His two older brothers got out of Dodge, to borrow a phrase, and Walt says, that's for me. At a young age, he wanted to enlist in the U.S. military for World War I. He was too young. He wanted to serve his country, which was an understandable notion for young men at the time. So he ended up lying about his age to volunteer for the ambulance corps. So he served in France just after the war was over, but enough to sort of leave an indelible mark on him.
Yeah, he and Hemingway had the same job.
That is correct.
They were both ambulance corps workers during World War I, even though I think by the time Walt got there, the war had basically ended, and Hemingway, because of his injury, doing that work wasn't doing that work. So my fantasy of Hemingway and Walt Disney being somehow in the same ambulance trying to do their work, that would be priceless, but yeah, like that didn't happen. But they both shared that need to experience what was happening in that war.
Absolutely. And Walt carries forward through his films the storyline, the mythology goes that Marceline sort of is this myopic vision of a perfect America. And that's sort of what mindset crystallized within him. So all animation feature films, what eventually became Disneyland, especially particularly Main Street, this was reconnecting, reclaiming that vision. Adventureland is going to tie into True Life Adventure films, and Fantasyland is for all the animation. But he wanted to reflect a slice of America that he wanted to project forward. Disneyland 1955, well, that made sense. You go back 50 odd years to the turn of the century. So here we are a century and a half later from that vision. It's still an iconic part of the park. It's sort of it crystallizes. Then going off on a tangent here, but to the right, you've got, at least in Florida, Tomorrowland. So Walt always had a foot in the past, celebrating American history and kind of wanting to shape how it was perceived, as well as a forward-thinking Walt who was fascinated and worked symbiotically with NASA to help accelerate their program to get NASA technology for Imagineering. I've borrowed other historians have used this phrase, but he had his two feet on the ground, one in the past, one in the future. So that, and he wanted to control the narrative of how the past was received and to shape how the future would unfold. You know, like a progress city during the 64 New York World's Fair. And
yeah, Marceline was this idealized town, which is a population small enough so that everybody knew each other. There was a downtown area where you could actually gather and meet people, and then when you got sick of that, you could go home and stay away from those people, because on the farm, you know, it's just harder to swing by. But then he saw what was happening with American inner cities, and he's like, his attitude wasn't, well, let's make Marceline all of America. Instead, he's like, okay, what are the needs of cities today?
Correct. Yeah.
And
yeah.
If anyone sees the short film, I know it's bouncing around YouTube, Epcot 66, you see his vision for what Walt Disney World was going to be. And he really doesn't talk about the theme parks other than that they would have one. He was going to design the city of the future. And if he had lived two more years,
different version.
Our memory of him would be radically different than it is now, because if his plan had worked at all, then we would see him as, you know, this brilliant social engineer.
Yeah.
And if it didn't, then we would imagine him as this crazed, psychotic entertainer who thought he could solve the world's problems and couldn't. Yeah. But it's hard for me to bet against Walt.
Yeah, you know, it's been in the news a lot lately, but Reedy Creek Improvement District all came about because of his ambitions for Epcot, the city, not the park. Timing-wise, he picked the worst time to die. He had already announced it. He had already prepared the Epcot film. Florida legislature was, you know, the Orlando Sentinel sniffed it out and published it, and they had to release it and get ready, and then he passes away before anything has really been solidified or gelled.
And the kind of corporate partnerships that were necessary for Epcot,
absolutely,
really only he could have made that work with his social clout. Capital. You know, so if he's like, no, this is our plan, it's going to work. You could say, well, I don't see how that's going to work. But he made Snow White work when no one thought that was a possible thing. He yes. made Disneyland work, even though everyone said this is insane.
Disney's folly.
So he made a career out of proving people wrong, doing some pretty amazing, extravagant things. I mean, there's that phrase that sometimes creeps me out. You know, I want everyone to remember it was all started by a mouse. And he said that in the context of a retrospective appreciation of Mickey Mouse on one of the anniversaries of Mickey Mouse that he did on the Walt Disney Presents TV show. And it's like, okay, that makes sense, but I've seen it used in Disney shows where it's like, and now we have Jesus because I created Mickey Mouse or something like that. And I'm just like, I don't, it's like, I like Mickey. I love the old Mickey.
Yep.
But I'm not sure I'm ready to concede that this was like a messianic thing that happened. It did save the Disney company, but the Disney company isn't the world.
Right.
But when we think like, okay, he and Ub Iwerks made cartoons and it led to the entire Disney experience. And it's just
mind-boggling
when you think about it.
Yeah, Ub is one of the most unheralded persons in the Disney history. I don't think he gets enough credit for his how he got the program launched. You know, what is now the Walt Disney Company today, a lot of it rests on Ub's shoulders, or more specifically, his animating hand.
The early cartoons, I think it was just him. They couldn't trust any other animators to even know about the project.
Correct. He was behind a locked door when Charles Mintz had bought off other members of his team, and Ub and Walt and Roy have the new Mickey Mouse character. And
there's, Ub is there's great footage in one of the Disney Treasures DVDs for the old black and white cartoons where they were looking at the original art for Steamboat Willie, I think, or maybe it was Plain Crazy, like one of the very early ones. And it was two of the nine old men were just studying the art, like page by page or cell by cell. And they were like, he was so decisive. Yes, it was a cruder animation style than the nine old men would learn to perfect, but like it was just pure art. Like, and he understood animation intuitively in a way that like, it takes decades, I think, for artists to be able to figure out. And it's like, nope, I need 100 drawings done today. Whoop, 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 whoop. And,
and then Ub was instrumental in taking the company in a new direction with the Silly Symphonies. Because this was, okay, we have a hit on our hands with Mickey Mouse. He's our corporate icon. We can't have him doing anything crazy or out of the ordinary because that will reflect badly on the company. So let's find a sandbox to play in. And Silly Symphonies came about. The first one was an Ub masterpiece, the Skeleton Dance. In terms of camera control, the concept, it was gag-driven, using a rib cage as a xylophone. But just, you know, the way the camera would pan in and out around the bones of a body.
It was just creepy, good fun.
Yes, yes, yes. So, the company at Walt's direction really grew organically. I mean, Walt, I wrote about this recently for Celebrations. I was talking about Bill Evans, the horticulturist for Disneyland. And Walt described himself as a honeybee. He pollinated ideas from one team to another. And I use that analogy to talk about Bill Evans because he was dealing with the byproducts of pollination, you know, plants and vegetation and what's appropriate for Disneyland and what he can do on the cheap because the construction of Disneyland, everyone goes back to that. Like, wow, they built Disneyland in 18 months. Why does it take 5 years for the Tron coaster? You don't know how much they skimped when they built Disneyland. I will put in a plug for Todd James Pierce's book, 3 Years in Wonderland, talks about the number of ancillary deals they had to make for costs, for construction, for promotions, the number of corners they had to cut.
Those were 18 harsh months, including the opening day, which managed to look okay on TV, but was pretty miserable for almost everyone actually there.
A hot, sticky mess with the gas leaks and carburetors overheating.
No water fountains.
Water fountains.
Because you could have working water for the water fountains or the toilets, but not both.
Right, right. So
Walt figured out. Yeah, Walt figured out. Okay, I know if they can only use it for one thing, I know what I want it to be.
That's right.
I think for a lot of people, you know, the patriotism just doesn't gel with like a contemporary way of looking at the world. I think of the traditional finale to the Main Street Electrical Parade, which entered Walt Disney World around the time of the bicentennial. And the closing float is this gigantic, American flag hanging off of an eagle while John Philip Sousa plays. And it's such a bummer. And the whole idea is we're just supposed to go, yes, we love America uncritically. And John Philip Sousa, and I'm like, one, I'm just against John Philip Sousa. It's too old fashioned and marchy for me. And I'm like, oh no.
Well, yeah, that makes me think of a Bill Murray and Stripes, you know, we're 10 and one. So,
it automatically makes my irony levels just raise up and my defenses start to come up.
That is.
Maybe Walt Disney would have loved it, but I think in 1960, it would play very differently than in 1976.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's the zeitgeist of the day. How is it perceived? Does it resonate, and resonate with whom? You know, going back to my book, you know, Walt has connections to all these 20th century presidents. And not surprisingly, the two that he has the most connections with are Southern California Republicans, Nixon and Reagan.
Walt was spared the biggest awkwardness with Nixon.
Yeah. This is true. Although Nixon's infamous "I am not a crook" speech happened on Walt Disney World property
at the Convention Center for the Contemporary.
Absolutely right. Yeah, he was on a image rehabilitation tour. He was doing an open Q&A session with the AP convention, reporters convention, and I include the full context of the quote in my book, but it ends with that line that everyone knows. They don't care how he got there. I think he was trying to defend his financial ethics about a book deal he had and how he cleaned his accounts. You know, he was ethically fit to be president from a financial optics. And let me be clear, I am.
Checkers part two.
Yes. Good deal.
And yeah, Walt was partisan a bit, but you know, I also, like, if you know his history in World War II.
That's a fascinating realm.
He, you know, the studio, first of all their overseas assets get frozen. Yeah. So
a lot of the workforce was called up to serve.
After Snow White,
yep.
He didn't have a hit.
Correct.
And the army takes over part of the studio.
Yes.
It says, we need these resources. And Walt is like, okay. And then the army goes, we need you to make movies for us. And the army charged him. They paid him what they thought his cartoons were worth, which had no relationship to how much those cartoons would cost. But he made some propaganda films, the series of Donald Duck, which are a little bit eye-opening sometimes. I kind of wish they didn't do that one.
Yeah,
Der Fuhrer's face is pretty amazing, but I think it's Commando Duck where I'm like, I realize the Japanese were the bad guys, but this is a little hard to watch.
It is. Yeah. That's the sort of thing. If it's on Disney Plus, there would be a big disclaimer at the top. You know, these were.
Oh, yeah. On the Disney Treasures, whenever Leonard Maltin interrupted your video viewing, you know, and you're like, this is going to be juicy. All right. He's like, the 1940s were different. Yeah. Okay.
That's exactly it.
But besides those, it sounds like there are hundreds of cartoons that just no one sees because they were meant internally for the army.
Right. And some animators had to have security clearances because they were doing, you know, exciting worlds of rivet design for the nearby Lockheed factory. And some of the work they were doing was classified at that time so that they had to animate in a separate room. They had to get some sort of background check. I don't think it was what level of DOD clearance it was.
And I presume they're dry and a little boring. So maybe there's a reason why they haven't been made publicly available, but I still find it fascinating. And so Walt is basically bankrupting himself or the company.
Yeah.
To try and make these films for the army that just keeps making more demands on him. And Walt didn't think like a businessman. One of the things that people generalize about him is he was a bad businessman. And I would disagree, but there were times when that wasn't the priority.
Correct.
His business philosophy was, no, if we take good care of the people who like what we do, they will be loyal and they will reward us for spending more to make quality products. Like, that's not an unreasonable business approach.
Right. Yeah, it's the holistic view. I will also point out that the studio worked hand in hand with primarily the Navy, as well as the other branches. The military at the time of World War II is not the way the DOD is structured today. So that's something I had to find out in my research. But Walt, the company, the studio, did a lot of insignias for the Army Navy. So that was another vehicle for supporting the war efforts. They did bond drives. They did animation for bond drives. And Walt had a pet project. He was really taken with the idea of air superiority, which went against Army and Navy doctrine. You advance on the ground, Navy supports, and Walt was taking the concept because, you know, air technology was nascent. There's no jet engines in World War II, at least not at the beginning. I don't think there was. And so he was taking on the notion of, I'm going to butcher his name, a naturalized U.S. citizen from Russia, Alexander Dessarevsky, I don't have my notes in front of me, who advocated in a book of the same title, Victory Through Air Power, about how you choke your enemy supply lines with pinpoint strategic air superiority. And Walt wanted to make a film out of this. He didn't have the Pentagon, the support of the military structure. So he says, I'm going to fund this on my own. So it's half animation, half narration, you know, live action narration. There's some
and
fascinating.
Part of it is the history of aviation, which kind of makes the second part seem more educational when it's actually making a military argument about strategy.
Precisely. So that, in fact, that was one of the first movies. RKO at the time was Disney's primary distributor before they went with their own in-house arm of Buena Vista Productions. So RKO didn't want to touch this. So United Features Syndicate, whatever, this is, and you know, for the trivia buffs, this is the only Disney film that they released. Or studio makes the product, somebody else releases it. You know, Disney does all that in-house now, but at the time they relied on RKO primarily to distribute their work. But yeah, I kept finding all of these interviews that Walt would do when he was in Washington, because he was out here a lot during the war years, presumably to talk to military brass, as well as working on this pet project of his. He stayed at the Mayflower Hotel every time he was in Washington, D.C. I wanted to visit it, but it was closed during my writing, research and writing. It's curious. That's his stomping grounds in D.C.
What's mind-boggling to me is just how much he had going on.
Absolutely.
So while some of this is going on, there's a strike, and that turned acrimonious pretty well from the beginning. And it's one of those cases where I can kind of see more than one point of view on this. In terms of Walt getting frustrated with unionization, but in particular, the union that a bunch of the animators seemed to be going with, led by a man who was threatening to destroy the company, which that had happened so many times to the Disney company that, if you needed to make sure Walt was going to be unreasonable and unbending, like you threaten the whole company. And he's never going to come to the middle if you do that, because the company had been threatened. Like it seems like one of the ways he learned how to build a giant company was through getting everything wrong the first time and getting betrayed like multiple times.
Yes. Charles Mintz, Pat Powers. Yes. Some of those early lessons. Yeah. He tried to, he made a company-wide statement to his employees gathered about why the union, why the efforts were not strong, or all the amount of money and attention he had poured in the company, and it wasn't received the way he wanted it to. So the strike resumed. In many of these situations, Roy steps up and resolves the issue on behalf of Walt. This is an opportunity where Walt gets to go to South America.
Walt goes on this goodwill tour of Latin American countries.
Yes.
In order to remind them of how much they like Mickey Mouse and Disney cartoons. So maybe they should just sit out World War II, even if they have autocratic leanings in their government, but maybe don't join the Axis powers and just watch what happens and remember how much, you know, you love Mickey Mouse and Disney cartoons. But also, you know, and I think this really explains so much about Walt Disney's approach to being a businessman and being a creative leader. The organization who wanted him to do this goodwill tour, he says, I don't want to go and just shake hands and pretend to get to know people. Like, this has to be a cultural exchange. This has to be a bona fide cultural exchange. And also he had them bankroll two movies that so they would be paid for whether they made any profit or not. And that turned out to be Saludos Amigos and The Three Caballeros.
For years, I was under the impression that it was the U.S. State Department that organized this. And it wasn't. It was this tiny government agency that was created by executive order in the early years of the war. It doesn't roll off the tongue very easily. The Office of the Coordinator for Inter-American Affairs. This was championed by Nelson Rockefeller, who had family business interests in South and Central America. And, you know, he's seeing the signs of Nazi sentiment, especially in Argentina. So, hey, this war might arrive in our hemisphere, whether we like it or not. So let's He's working with FDR to say, let's get Hollywood individuals to do goodwill. So, you know, I think Bing Crosby was part of it. Famous director who did
Orson Welles.
Yes. So, and then of course, Walt. Now, Walt brings his team with him. The notable.
He brings a plane full of the people he doesn't hate at his company during the strike.
Yeah. Yeah. Mary Blair. Herb Ryman are some of the standout names. I think it was between Stan and Ollie, one of them went, or maybe both, two of his nine old men. And they separated, you know, they flew into Rio. From there, they all went through different itineraries throughout South America. And, you know, Mary is doing concept art. They had a musician soaking up the local music. Walt is using this opportunity to do premieres in other cities for Fantasia. So he's like you said, hey, if I'm down here on this Goodwill tour, it's not just me making a statement to the press. I'm going to get out there. And the original contract called for 12 one-reel shorts. And what we know came about was actually two feature-length films, Saludos Amigos and The Three Caballeros.
Barely features, but features nonetheless.
Precisely.
They got over the one-hour mark.
They were basically three of the contracted shorts were combined into one feature, and three of the next were combined into another. A third film focusing on Cuba, Carnival, was in the early works. I know Mary Blair had done some preliminary sketch work, but that the war was over, and the office was basically, this executive office was disbanded by then.
And the spigot was turned off.
Yes, precisely. Whatever a remaining function it had was subsumed by the State Department.
So while I feel gypped that we didn't get a Cuba movie, on the other hand, if I have to imagine these Latin American movies as having a trajectory, I don't know what's even possible after The Three Caballeros. It's my favorite Disney feature.
Yes.
It's got some slow moments, but the last half hour, it's the most intense drug trip anyone who doesn't take drugs can experience.
Right.
And so now that you've done that, yeah, like you shouldn't try. So part of me is okay that the Cuba film didn't get past the planning stages.
Yeah. Ward Kimball did some really outlandish animation during the finale with on the rooster. I'm going to forget the names. Donald
Panchito.
Thank you. And Jose Karaoke. This is the 1940s when he's doing this. This is the stuff that with CGI enhancement you could pull off, but he was all over the page, literally.
I tell my friends, if you thought like the weirder parts of Fantasia were great, they're like a Diet Coke compared to the Three Caballeros.
A good point. But yeah, that's well documented in my book, The Whole South American Tour.
And at times when there's a public record, you quote extensively from the public record, which I also, that's one of the strengths of the book. So after the strike, Walt Disney, like years later, testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee, basically to talk about the problems he had with his strike and the influence that communism maybe had played into parts of that dispute. Frankly, I think it was probably just more personal than most of that. But yeah, that's one of those factoids that is remarkable, right? In movies today, the person testifying as a friendly witness for the House Un-American Activities Committee is not the good guy. But this isn't a movie. This is actual history. And seeing the record and seeing the way Walt talked about it, this was not a hatchet job. And he didn't make bigger claims than he thought he could make. And so this is not simply him lashing out as harshly as he could, but rather him just trying to figure out, you know, what influence communists might be having. And of course, in the year 2022, that sounds really quaint that like, oh, communists are going to like, and he does say weird things like, oh yeah, because a communist has to be un-American.
Yeah,
and he uses that phrase like a bunch of times. That makes me wonder, like, okay, how are we defining being an American? But the 1950s are a lot different than now. But I felt like the public record on that answers a question that I've had as a Disney fan for years and years and years, which is, yeah, what the hell did he say? And what was about that? I never quite got so agitated that I tracked down the information, but you tracked it down for me. So thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating history. This part leading up to this was fun for me to write because I had firsthand experience of working on Capitol Hill. I know the Cannon House office building. That's not where I worked at the time, but I'm very familiar with that building. And I'm just skimming through my book right now. Not only was Walt Claus a friendly witness, but at that time, Ronald Reagan was the president of the Screen Actors Guild, and he was called to testify. Different day, but you know, you talk about the Venn diagram of these two keep overlapping each other.
Well, and Ronald Reagan was one of the co-hosts on the opening day of Disney World telecast, and it's bizarre because he's like number three or four in the batting order of like, and he just looks like a nice goofball roaming around trying to be cheerful and describe what's going on.
Right.
And it's like, this is a man who would have his access to the nuclear codes later. And he doesn't seem that serious, which admittedly, that's not what the gig would have called for anyway.
Right. And fast forward to the 80s during his Reagan second inauguration, it was a bitter cold snap in Washington, D.C. So all outdoor activities were canceled. And so Disney reaches out to the presidency and they say, well, let's do a redo. We'll have a second inauguration parade at Epcot. A lot of the original bands that were supposed to perform in Washington were reinvited down there. So not all could make it, but hey, there he is again, showing up on that Venn diagram. Yeah, that going back to his testimony, there is YouTube videos of it, you know, transcribed from film, and it wasn't as my expectation was that he would have the floor to himself and the big dais in front of him. It looked like there were several things going on at once. The camera is a static camera. Focused on Walt giving testimony. He's got three or four network radio station microphones in front of him. And we can't see who's addressing him, but we hear voices. And it's just a static recap of his testimony. And it's been transcribed, which I was able to include in the book. But it didn't look, from what little I could capture, that it was this major, almost January 6th style type of hearing. So I think his testimony was on a Friday even. So maybe that's sort of a... got lost in the shuffle. He was not the leadoff batter for this.
Day when boring news stories come out or the news stories people want to hide come out.
Yes. That is precisely where my thought was. I wasn't quite sure how to phrase that. Yeah. He's got testimony before Congress, ties presidents. We've established that he's a Republican-leaning president.
Well, Republican back then.
Back then, yeah. Yeah. What would he be today? So 1964.
Oh, the big ad for Ike.
Yeah.
Unofficially, yeah. Disney animators worked on that. I think it was a 1-minute animated ad.
Correct.
That had the theme song that says, I like Ike.
Yep. Like a parade of all these individuals going by.
And I'm sure the audience thought that looks like Disney, even if the Disney name was nowhere on it.
Right. It was all done after hours on personal time, and they were reimbursed not from the Disney company, but from the campaign, so to speak. So
another juicy controversy you dig into is the Disney's America fiasco. One of the first times Michael Eisner seemed to have a major misstep.
Correct. Yeah.
And I find it shocking that Disney thought their plan was going to work. In particular, and I'm not referring necessarily to the environmental and historical impacts that historians and local residents were worried about before that. Like, okay, we're going to tell American history in this wonderfully dynamic way. And it's like...
the Disney way,
yeah. So how do you present slavery the Disney way? How do you present genocide the Disney way? And...
you can't. Not without...
not legitimately. No. And I guess, you know, if we think back to the American Adventure Show.
Precisely. That's what I was going to talk about. They acknowledge it.
I don't think they acknowledge slavery. I mean, technically,
yeah,
there's
right.
A Civil War, but they don't go, oh, and by the way, there were centuries of... they do have an important speech from, I believe it's Chief Seattle, that they altered to make it a little bit less acerbic than it actually was. But it's a moment where he interrupts the show to go, oh yeah, by the way, you've destroyed my people, which is a bummer, but is a necessary bummer if you're going to even pretend to present American history. So it's like, let's expand this into a whole park. And it's like, how are you going to, like, I guess part of the success of Liberty Square in the Magic Kingdom is, okay, it was pretty early in American history and we don't have to talk about everything.
Right. We're at a narrow, defined scope. We're colonials. We're fighting for independence. You're right. This is, the South is, they're with us, but you know, they're part of the 13 colonies, but we're not going to talk about everything that's going on.
So you remember this as a resident. And so you were probably paying attention to it closer than I was in real time.
Yeah. So, you know, I live in Fairfax County, which if you do an aerial view of Washington, D.C., it's the Virginia side of D.C. is Arlington County. It would complete the Washington, D.C. was originally going to be a diamond shaped, and Arlington County represents the Virginia side of the diamond. And then surrounding that is Fairfax County. To the west of that is Prince William County. And that is where Disney have purchased the rights to land to build this park. Though ExxonMobil, I'm not sure if they're merged at that time, they had an option on this large tract of land. And Disney says, okay, well, we're noodling the idea for a park. We need to be near major airports, major roads, within certain population bases. This location checked off all the boxes. And not unlike Disney World, they kind of weren't ready to reveal what they had, because the Wall Street Journal got wind of something was going on, that Disney was planning something for Northern Virginia. It didn't have the details. So Disney had to, by Disney, I mean Eisner, had to come out and say, okay, we got plans. And they had to spin up the local state and local politicians. Okay, this is our plan. We're going to go through with this. This area, Prince William County, is largely, trying to find the right municipality phrase to use here. There's only a handful of incorporated cities. Otherwise, it's at the county locality. One of those is the town of Haymarket, small, rural, almost a Marceline-style town. And the mayor of Haymarket didn't know that this plan was afoot until he read about it in the paper, that's something very, very clandestine and very Disney-esque. It goes back to the land acquisition for Walt Disney World. So Disney has kind of already behind the eight ball. They've had to announce this. They don't, Imagineering and the story writers haven't fully vetted out what the park's going to look like, what attractions will be there, what stories are they going to tell, how are they going to do it. Bob Weiss was in charge of this project at the time. He's now the global ambassador for Imagineering. You know, he's a German immigrant, so he should be presumably as sensitive to the American dream and the notion of fairness. I think on day one, he was quoted as, you know, it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to, his opening remarks was read as, oh, we're going to recreate the slavery situation for you and it'll be fun. And Disney PR had to say, wait, he's not our call spokesperson on this.
There's no coming back from that. Yeah.
And so, you know, it was announced in November of 94 and scuttled in the spring or summer of 95. And it was this pre-internet battle for the hearts and minds of what, you know, Disney was throwing goodwill at local politicians. You know, we're going to bring revenue to your districts. We're going to pay for road widening here. There's pushback, not so much from within Prince William County, but a little bit.
Oh, good.
Bit for
road construction in Washington, D.C.
Exactly. I remember bumper stickers at the time that people opposed to it. They have these bumper stickers that Interstate 66, Disney's new parking lot, ? So, you know, you got to get the sound bite, get your meme in real quick. So you've got bona fide historians who are objecting to the notion that Disney's going to tell the story.
David McCullough came out against it. And it's like, what are you going to argue with David McCullough? Like, how are you going to look like the good guy arguing with David McCullough?
Right. Yeah. Ken Burns was on the opposition. I think Doris Kearns Goodwin. And then you also have these local factions of landowners in Prince William who love the idea of having a job, steady income, a construction or workers and tourists coming by. They are salivating at this. And then beyond the hills into the rolling Piedmont, up to the foot of the Blue Hills, the Blue Ridge Mountains, is the quote unquote landed gentry of Blue Bloods. And they are not taking a shine to the notion of tacky tourist trips coming in.
I don't want to look out my front window and see a 7-Eleven.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, they want to see horse farms. not that. So there was, and then there also had environmental concerns that you alluded to. The Clean Air Act had just been passed a few years earlier, and the D.C. metropolitan area was already failing at this. And you're introducing the concept of X number of increase of automobile vehicles on the road and exhaustion.
The historian complaints, if I remember correctly, it wasn't that Disney was going to make bad history as a story. In all fairness, like, we don't know what they would have done.
Right.
But it was more a case of, if you bring too many tourists into this historic location where there are bona fide historical sites, that those historical sites are going to be at risk and overcrowded and neglected. So they were just worried about what happens to these protected historical sites if Disney builds a giant, I mean, it wouldn't have been giant by Disney standards, but it would have been giant by local standards, park.
That was a major argument against it. You've got that, you know, so you've got, for better or for worse, you've got historical cultural sites like Battle of Bull Run site was nearby. You've got Monticello a few hours away. Washington's Mount Vernon is in Alexandria, up to an hour away, depending on traffic. You've got a large cultural base of museums, aka the Smithsonian, within Washington, D.C., to better prospectively, you know, share the optics of American history.
And maybe Disney enhances all of that, or maybe Disney overwhelms all of that. And there's no way to tell until you let them do it. But if you let them do it, it's too late.
Right. And we talked earlier about, you know, Eisner. He came out of the gates swinging on this, and he had the local support of the business community and politicians. But at the end, he pulled out. A couple of reasons. One, he's got the death of Frank Wells, his number one right-hand man. I think that he was the yin to Michael's yang. I think the two, and people have made the comparisons between Walton Roy to Michael and Frank, and I think those are reasonably accurate comparisons. So I think without the counterweight of Frank Wells, Michael Eisner was sort of in the dark.
Well, and what we learned about Michael Eisner is he needed Frank Wells to be a human buffer.
Yep.
That Frank Wells was the guy who would smooth things over.
Precisely.
So even the, like, I think the Walt and Roy analogy is a little inexact. Like, Roy would rein Walt in terms of spending, which it scared Walt when Roy looked, I think it was, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and the special effects went wrong with the squid. And that was like, I don't know, they just, all that money for that shooting day was gone. And Roy said, no, it'll be fine. Like, it looks good. And then that scared Walt. He's like, has he lost his mind, or might I actually know what I'm doing? I don't know.
Precisely. Yeah. So I think Eisner also, I couldn't get my hands on this. It's buried in the vault somewhere at the Disney Archives, but there was an internal report prepared. And according to witnesses who have read this, they really scale back the ambition of the park in terms of operating hours, because the reality is Northern Virginia, we might have a mild winter, we might have two back-to-back snowmageddons. So they really had to scale back the operational capacity of the park. Was it going to be a food and wine type festival park, or was it going to be a theme park? Ultimately, the proposed budget skyrocketed. All the criticism, and, you know, Eisner says, I don't want to give this brand a black eye any more than it has right now. So he politely says, we're going to table the plans for the park. We'll think about where else we want to put it, which was corporate speak for so long. We're done. When it was the first announced, I was like, my jaw dropped to the floor. This is great. Disney's going to be 20 minutes away from me. And, you know, in hindsight, it's probably for the best that it didn't come to be. Getting to Orlando for me is a special, exotic level of vacation. It's not something I can just pick up and go to when I want to. And honestly, I don't take advantage nearly enough of all the cultural landmarks that DC has to offer. And if you want to see American history, go through it that way. I've been to the archives. I wanted to get into the Library of Congress, but during my research phase, it too was closed.
Damn you, COVID.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's not in the context of this book, but the DC has the Holocaust Museum, which is something that, as painful as that is, everyone who visits DC should visit that museum.
So as part of the inspiration for this book, and I'm definitely segueing away from the Holocaust Museum, sometimes when I'm looking at actual historical places, and this has to be a historian's nightmare, my brain goes, oh yeah, like at Walt Disney World. When I see the actual things, visiting Coronado Island, and I'm like, oh yeah, some of this looks familiar. And I'm like, oh, that's right. Yeah, some of this has inspired some of the things in Walt Disney World. And I'm like, this is me literally killing history. And I have a PhD. Like, I'm an intellectual. And part of me is like, yep, look, Disney right there. And I imagine some of the architecture in DC, it's dusk, and it's that's the Hall of Presidents right there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, the Hall of Presidents was inspired a lot by the official White House decorum and design patterns, very deliberate design choices. And there's a long-running internet rumor that the presidential seal, which is on the floor of the Hall of Presidents, is like one of only two authorized outside of the White House. And that, I think, has been debunked. I really wanted to suss that out and have I couldn't get a clear answer on either side. So like, okay, we're just going to leave it out. But yeah, it's in the city recently. I've been to Union Station, our train station, a number of times recently, and you drive down Constitution Avenue, and on your left and right, there's just this majestic architecture, you know, largely from the FDR era, when a lot of these monolithic giants, these buildings were created. There's a great diversity with the Smithsonian, particularly the newer ones. The Native American Museum and the African American Museums are exterior-wise just beautiful architecture. And I will do I have a whole section on the Smithsonian in my book. The downside to any museum is that there's only so much exhibit space.
Yeah.
And at any given moment, they can only have so much on display. The rest is in storage. But they beautifully catalog all of their holdings. And so they have some really unique Disney-related ephemera and products. For Disneyland's 50th anniversary back in 2005, was it?
Yep.
They donated, Disneyland donated, and the Disney Company donated a teacup from the original park, a Flying Dumbo, some of the original posters, and like a ticket book for the Mark Twain, because that had a separate ticket book, ticket price. It was not part of the A through C at the time of Disneyland opening day. So it's unique. I remember seeing those on display. I did my escort of my.
I've used ticket books before as a child. I think it was maybe 15 years ago. I tried to give someone an e-ticket when I was getting in line for Space Mountain, and the poor cast member had no idea what that even was. So she thought I was some like crazy person.
That's great. Oh, I love it.
like I just got stuck in a time machine and I didn't know what time I was in. So here, you're going to need this e-ticket so I can get on.
So
that's the kind of comedian I am, the kind of jokes where no one gets it.
Is this on? This mic on? But you bring up Space Mountain, and you talk about, I'll segue over to Disney's interaction with NASA. You know, it was announced as a civilian agency in 1959, and you know, the Cold War and the space race with Sputnik, this jump-started this American need for control of the skies. You know, if the Russians get there first, we'll be at their mercy from nuclear warheads from above. So you look at the early Mercury, Gemini, Apollo programs, and what helped to jumpstart that was Wernher von Braun captured.
And Ward Gimbel.
Yes. Those two had an amazing collaboration. Ward was fascinated by some of the writings in Collier's magazine that Wernher von Braun had co-authored. And, you know, we need content for the Disneyland television anthology series. We need content for Tomorrowland. Let's work with this guy. So, and von Braun, his initial concepts of space travel were kind of spot on. Getting into suborbital launches. I'm talking above my pay grade here, but Disney had some collaboration with declassified military / NASA technology, which they incorporated into the audio animatronics. When you've seen the videos of Walthall Rogers wearing the rig, you know, on his hand, heads, whatever. So he's imitating a puppet, and they're recording this to analog tape to play back. And that is how the guy sitting in his chair with his pipe and talking to Rover on the floor, that comes from the collaboration with yes, Disney.
It's basically audio animatronic rotoscoping.
Yes, precisely. I like that. That's that.
It's not some guy, you know, doing math in a computer.
Right. It's not our animator.
It's let's do a motion capture of the motions of this person who is enacting a part in the story.
Yeah. And advance a few years to the Enchanted Tiki Room, or actually advance back really, I guess. This was Walt's pet project. You know, he wanted the birds to be the show. So they've recorded all these recordings. Very rudimentary in the sense that it's all binary. It's like on or off, beak open, beak closed, head turned left, head turned right. And
but their stomachs puff out when they take a breath, which is the one detail that makes it real. You're like, this is just it. But yeah, they're crude, like animatronics based on like almost everything that came after.
Yeah.
But there's just enough realism in there to like get you to stop thinking this is fake.
Yeah,
look
right
at that. That's fake. And it's like,
That's a great point. I will look for that the next time I'm in the show.
It's just one little extra detail, but it completely sells.
Eye blinks help, like I said, the head turns. Yeah. But that's all in the early stages of animatronics. And that was, not to keep circling back, but that was some military technology declassified that was put to use for Walt, that he put to use with his Imagineering team. So, yeah, it says, I'm going to hold up my book for all of your video viewers to see this, but I will tell you more about where it's available.
Go right ahead.
I stood up my own website, jamieheckerwriter.com, real original title, I know. But this is where the challenge with this book was I couldn't really include photos. I had some illustrations at the very beginning that lays out Washington, D.C.'s the National Mall. Because thematically, I tried to tie everything around to the mall. So I had to have a map for that. But in terms of all the documentation and photos that I came across in my research, it wasn't feasible to include them in the book. So I'm a one-man marketing machine. I have my own Twitter and Instagram account, so I keep periodically posting photos related to the book, which get pumped out to Twitter and on my website.
So I presume this is available on Amazon, but is there a place you would prefer people to buy it if they don't want to support?
That's the dilemma.
That mega corporation.
Only place. I have shopped around with some of my local independent bookstores here in the DC area, thinking this would be a perfect tie-in. Alas, I have not had any nibbles or even responses. So it's at some point it'll be available on Kindle, but again, that's part of the Amazon oligarchy. So it is a print-on-demand book. You will get it in 48 hours or so. I learned the hard way that when you submit a manuscript that you have treated as your own baby and you don't let others proofread it on your behalf because you're too stubborn, well, sloppiness gets printed. So I've had a few revisions to my publisher. Page 72, please fix this. So from a writer's optics, I learned a lot.
It's very important when you get to that stage to have other people proofread it, if you can find anyone, because this is what happens. You, like a paranoid maniac, you scour the whole book looking for any mistake, and you find some and you correct them, and then you get the book, and then you randomly flip open a page, and you're like, oh, crap. And it requires, after you get it published, it requires no strenuous effort to find mistakes because it's almost like
proofreaders, some early buyers of the book, they kindly pointed out some gross mistakes I made. I misspelled the word Boeing, as in the Boeing Corporation. I'm like, oh my God, how did that happen? So I sent two or three pages of revisions to my publisher, and he's included them all in the master copy. So if there's anything else sloppy, well, let's chalk that up to rookie long form writing.
Well, I've been following Disney history for a bunch of years. Maybe I'm a Disney historian if we count my few articles for Celebrations magazine, which I definitely loved writing. So if you're a big Disney fan and you don't subscribe to Celebrations, let me recommend that. But also your book, Jamie, as someone who's just been gobbling up as much Disney history as I can over, let's say, 25 years, I've been intensely digging in to Disney history, and this is an important contribution to my library. And I kind of love how you just have these different ways of going into the ways that Walt Disney as a man and the Disney company have been involved in national politics, even in quiet ways and sometimes secret ways. But also, I think you kind of offer a lot of complexity and understanding what all of that means, since, like, even if Walt Disney had some strong political opinions, overall, that's like, he was statement. A pretty complicated
man. Well, thank you. And, let me share with you on a final note here, for anyone who is thinking of a summer trip to Washington, D.C., or anytime in 2023, I don't have the exact details yet, but a great contact I developed at the Smithsonian Museum of American History. She's an archivist specializing in the Disney brand and its relationship to American history. She's preparing an exhibit that will be on display at the Smithsonian in 2023. I will be watching.
And you're going to be part of that.
Reading it. They recently solicited a lot. this made its way through the Twitter and Facebook Disney feeds, that they were soliciting family photos of you and your family at Disney vacation parks. So that, they got thousands of submissions. Who knows what it's going to get whittled down to. I tossed one of our family pictures in there. So, hey, maybe not. But it's going to be a unique exhibit. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Jamie Hecker, Chelsea Alice for editing this episode, and of course, our sponsor, Scribophile. If you liked what you heard today, please do share the episode on social media. Leave a review over at Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you stream this thing. That would be deeply helpful. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Perfect Advice from Dr. Perfect, comic book reviews from Drew Barth, and reviews of Schlock by our curator of Schlock, Jeff Schuster. All right, gang, until next time, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week, I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Mama, I'm just a duck, but I'm human. I can't stand this so much.
Kungaloosh.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.